we will be taking a look at your pet's health over the next 90 minutes or so. Larry Mueller here, so happy to have you listening in. My guest expert, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, a professor of veterinary medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her back, and she'll be with us till 12:30 today to answer your questions. When you join us, the number is 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. Or, again, go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post there and a question there, a comment. Maybe get a cool pet picture. Post that, too. Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
It is so nice to be back.
You have got some important information about why prevention of heartworm is more important than ever. Can you talk about that?
Well, I definitely can. And it's kind of sad because, you know, with the economy the way it is, people have been probably cutting back on things. And one of the things they've cut back on is using heartworm preventative. And we have it. I mean, I just had a heartworm positive dog here in Madison. Yeah, that lived just on the other side of the vet school, kind of, you know, just in the center of Madison here. So it's alive and well everywhere, we, you know, pretty well across the country. But the big concern we have is that if a dog does contract heartworm, the treatment, the only licensed treatment for heartworm, it's a drug called imidacide, is made by a company called Mariel, is not being manufactured. There's a big issue with manufacturing it. I don't know all the details, but Muriel sent us a letter and just said, if you've got any, use it, you know, sparingly. And so we had enough to treat one dog at the vet school, and we're having to make decisions now as to who gets treated. So you have to actually apply to be able to get it. And once it runs out, I don't know what we're going to do. So it's a disease that can be prevented. So prevent it, definitely. And, you know, if your dog gets it, well, you know, hopefully there'll be, you know, some medication available to treat, but there may not be.
And so, prevention is
about $10 a month. For the medication. It also controls intestinal parasites. And that's kind of an average. I mean, when I say $10, that's just a ballpark figure, because if you've got a little teeny dog, it's going to be a lot less expensive than a big dog.
Okay.
And there are lots of different prices of medications out there. There's some generic forms that you can get online now. So, you know, if you have to be price conscious, talk to your veterinarian about, you know, what you could use that may cost a little bit less.
We have an email from Sue who wanted you, actually it was from our Facebook page, wondering if you would comment on the evidence for safety to the dog when we use those topical drops for flea and tick prevention.
Yeah. You know, the EPA did a big study looking at this a couple of years ago, and what they found is that the big issue where we saw most of the reactions and toxicities and so on is related to the fact that it wasn't used appropriately. So it was people buying things over the counter, using a dog product on a cat, using the wrong size product on the dog, not putting it in the right spot, putting it on pets, and then they lick each other and ingest it. All different things that way. The products that are probably the safest that you're going to get are the ones that your veterinarian recommends. There are lots and lots of products available at pet stores, but again, you don't have your veterinarian there with their knowledge to be able to make sure that they're choosing a healthy product for your pet. I think from my point of view, the risk of fleas and ticks and the tick-borne diseases especially, you have to weigh out, you know, using a chemical or not using a chemical. And probably one of the safest ones on the market is Frontline. It's kind of the industry standard.
Yep.
Good safety profile. They've come out with a kind of a new improved Frontline. It's called CertiFect. Just came out in the last month, and it has a little bit of another chemical called Ametraz in it that is not enough to kill ticks, but enough to make them kind of dance around on the dog so that they pick up more of the Frontline that's on the hair, and they die very quickly before they can attach. So nice addition for those pet people that maybe live in northern Wisconsin where ticks are really, really bad.
Really bad. We have one more Facebook message from Travis. On a previous show, Dr. Sawchuk said that grapes are toxic to dogs, nephrotoxic to dogs. Specifically, what is it in grapes that is the toxin, and what other animals are likely to be similarly affected? Are there, you know, fruits and vegetables that have this toxin and should be avoided?
Wow, good question. We don't know what's in grapes, but we know grapes and raisins, both. I mean, raisins are just dried grapes. And that there seems to be an individual dog variation as well. Some dogs are very, very sensitive, and others, if they eat a grape or two, not a big deal. And so it comes down to the dog sensitivity, the volume of what they're getting. And so if they're eating raisins, obviously they're able to consume a lot of those. Compared to grapes,
yeah,
it's just best to keep them away. And it's kind of like, you know, one of my favorite foods is macadamia nuts. I don't eat them very often because they're, you know, high in calories and so on. But they're a problem for dogs as well. What's in there that allows us to be able to eat them but not dogs? One of the other things that's a huge problem, we just had a dog die from this, and I, you know, told the people in critical care that I'd bring it up on your show, is xylitol toxicity. Xylitol is a sweetener that's used in a lot of preparations for human use, such as sugarless gums. There was a product on the market that this, what happened to this client is their dog ended up getting into a bottle of a prescription that their dentist had prescribed. The owner had dry mouth, and there's a mint product that is like 100% xylitol. And to us, it's just a, you know, it makes things sweet and so on, and it helps prevent plaque formation on our teeth. But for dogs, it drops their insulin level, puts them into liver failure. And this dog, they left in the morning. It was fine. He sometime during the day got into the bottle of these. They came home. The dog was in a coma and died later that evening. Even with intensive care management. So keep your sugarless gum away from your dog if it's got xylitol in it.
Stella in Sturgeon Bay has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Stella. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call, too. Sandy, I have a question about our kitty, some human foods that she really loves if they're safe for her.
Okay.
She loves butternut squash.
Not a problem.
And walnuts.
Not to my knowledge. I don't think there's a problem with walnuts, no.
Okay, I've just given her like little bitty pieces.
Mm-hmm.
She just scarfs them down.
Okay.
And we very rarely have it, but if we have peanut butter, she loves peanut butter.
Okay. And I don't think any of those products are going to be an issue for your cat. The big things that we get worried about in cats that come from our kitchen are primarily the onions and garlic, any of those types of things. So trying to keep that away from your cat. We ran into this a few years ago where people would use like human meat baby food as a way of like tempting a cat that was feeling ill and not wanting to eat. And it was a food that you could syringe into their mouth. And baby food had a lot of garlic powder and things to make it taste better for the adults that are probably feeding the baby and sampling it themselves. So I think that's pretty well been taken out of the off the market. But yeah, trying to keep that away from your pet if you can. But what your cat's eating, it doesn't sound like it's going to be a big problem unless they ate a big enough piece of walnut that it became a foreign body, or you know, they have a weight issue. Peanut butter, as you know, is not the lowest.
Squash would be good though. Yeah.
Squash is good. My cat loves cantaloupe. That's every day she gets a little slice, chopped up slice of cantaloupe. So yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling, Alicia in Duluth, Minnesota. We'll turn to you now. Hi.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Dr. Sawchuk, I have Manx. He's 8 years old. He has just been, I came home after being out of town for a few days and noticed there was something different, and he has possibly had a stroke. Have you had many feline clients with this situation? And can you tell me a little bit more about it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm wondering if your cat actually had a cerebral vascular accident. Typically, when we see that in cats, it's usually kitties that have an issue with being hypertensive. So elderly cats in chronic renal failure, sometimes cats that are hyperthyroid. An 8-year-old cat, unlikely to be hypertensive. We just rarely ever see it in young cats. It can happen, but it's just not that common unless they've got some other underlying health problems. Probably the thing that gets misdiagnosed as a stroke is, especially for whatever reason, it seems seems to occur around this time of the year, there's a condition that is called idiopathic vestibular disease. And we don't know, idiopathic means we don't know what causes it. It's kind of like Meniere's disease that people get, where all of a sudden you have an acute onset of losing your balance. And so they're rolling around, their eyes are flicking, they may be yowling, they can't get up and walk. And typically, most cats that develop this get over it within a few days. And so, you know, if your kitty's getting better, that may be what it is. But a good thorough neurologic exam is going to differentiate whether your cat has an issue with its balance apparatus or whether it's actually a vascular accident to the brain. So I hope that you've taken your kitty into your veterinarian and had them evaluate your cat, because, you know, I think it would really give you some peace of mind if you knew it was something that may just disappear and go away.
Oh, that would be lovely. And yes, he has been in for a checkup, and the right side of his body is definitely different than the left, and that's what I noticed immediately.
Okay.
So we're keeping an eye on it to see if he improves, or if it might be a tumor. If he gets worse, then we go from there.
Yeah, we do have, in the veterinary world, neurologists. And at the veterinary school, we've got two boarded neurologists and some really great residents that work with them as well. And so if it ever comes down to, you know, a point where you feel that you need either a second opinion, or your veterinarian is like, well, I'm at a loss, I don't know what else I can do, that might be a good path to go. And you know, we have the ability to do MRIs and CT scans and so on to be able to get some answers for you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And we have lots of callers here. Elaine, you are next. Hi, Elaine in Appleton.
Hello, thank you. I babysit this dog. He's so sweet. But he has a canker or something in his ear. It's like wax coating.
Mm-hmm.
And it smells like yeast, and they've had him into the doctor, who gave him medicine for about 9 days, and it still hasn't cleared up.
Yeah, and, you know, whenever we're dealing with ear infections, a couple of the important things, and I hope that the veterinarian that saw the dog did this, number one is look in the ear. If the ear is really, really painful, which in many cases it can be, we may have to even sedate the patient to be able to do a good, thorough examination. Sometimes dogs with ear disease also have a ruptured eardrum, and the infection has gone from just being in the ear canal to down into the middle ear cavity as well, and those can be more problematic to treat. And, you know, while we're in there, we're looking to see if there's a foreign body. Sometimes dogs will get little grass seeds and things down in their ears, especially the dogs with the real droopy ears. And, you know, we'll even see tumors and kind of oddball stuff that way. Getting a swab of the material from the ear and looking at it under the microscope to determine, not just from odor, but actually visualizing what the bugs are there, yeast, bacteria, and sometimes we'll even have to culture the material to be able to find out what the appropriate antibiotic would be if there is a bacterial infection there, because sometimes ears are one of those spots where we can see a lot of resistant bugs. Primarily the one that we see in the ear canal is Pseudomonas, which has a real foul smell and can be pretty tricky to treat. They tend to have a lot of different antibiotic resistances as well. So I hope that that's what happened. Many times dogs with chronic yeast infections, yeast are a normal inhabitant of the ear. And so when we look at any dog's ears and take a swab, even from a healthy, clean ear, you're going to find the odd yeast. But when they start to overgrow, there's usually an underlying reason. Something's changed the microenvironment in the ear to make it more suitable for the yeast to grow. And whether it be something like a foreign body or a growth or whatever, or it could be something as simple as allergies. Dogs that are allergic, their ear becomes a little more inflamed, and it can just be one. It doesn't have to be both. And that allows the yeast to grow. So instead of just treating the infection, you have to actually get to the underlying cause, and that may mean dealing with chronic allergy problems as well. So I think it's time, if it's not better, time to go back to the veterinarian, have it looked at again. And that's why whenever I get an ear infection in, I always recommend that we get these dogs back in just, you know, when treatment is coming to a close, so that we can see if we've got it cleared up and, you know, if not, you know, where we can take it to the next
level.
Where
we go next. Okay. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Elaine. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at veterinary medicine at the University of Wisconsin Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller. Brittany DeAnda, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we have lots of calls and lots of questions for Dr. Sandy, so we'll get right back to it with an email question from Brady. We recently noticed our cat's lymph nodes were swollen. We took her to the vet, was determined she most likely had an infection. They're reviewing blood samples for possible lymphatic system cancer. Currently giving our cat 20 milligrams of Baytrol? Pills daily. Are there any natural remedies for an infection as opposed to conventional medicine? She's 10 years old and on a grain-free diet.
Well, unfortunately not. But I really get worried when, typically if you've got an infection, kind of like if you've got, you've got an upper respiratory infection.
Yes.
Right now, I would bet that if you felt your neck, you probably have some enlarged lymph nodes down in your neck area because you're dealing with all the goobers in your nose, okay? But you're not going to have the lymph nodes in your armpits being big because you don't have any infection there. The writer didn't say whether the lymph nodes are big everywhere. If they are, then I'd be really concerned about what's going on. And I think getting a needle biopsy of one or more of the lymph nodes and actually having a veterinary pathologist look at it to determine whether they're normal, just reactive lymph cells, which would happen if there is an infection going on, or whether they're neoplastic or cancer-like cells. Being a 10-year-old cat, you're kind of in that zone of it could definitely be cancer. And one of the things that we like to know is the cat's status for feline leukemia virus, which can cause lymphoma. And so if that hasn't been evaluated, if it was done as a kitten, make sure it's rechecked again. So get that blood test done for feline leukemia and FIV to rule that out as a cause as well.
Okay. Then we had a Facebook message from Bev. 3 months ago, we took in a kitty about 7 weeks old, unbeknownst to us. The kitty came with fleas. We live in the country and have always had cats, never had fleas, so we dutifully applied BioSpot to all 7 of the strays we have taken in. The fleas seem to get worse, so now we want to switch to Frontline, which supposedly works better. I applied the BioSpot on September 5th. How long should I wait to apply the Frontline?
Well, this just goes to show you BioSpot's one of those available over-the-counter products that's available. And there are two types of BioSpot on the market. There's dog BioSpot, which if you put that on a cat, would kill it. And there's cat BioSpot, which is a very, very weak product. It's it just helps prevent some of the flea eggs from developing into larval stages. It's an insect growth regulator, and it just really does not work very well at all. So I think that they would be better off using something that's going to give you good long-lasting effect, that's going to have adulticidal effect, meaning it's going to kill the adult fleas and give residual effect so that when the new fleas jump up, they will die. And so there's several products on the market besides Frontline. You could talk to your veterinarian about using Advantage, would be another one that's safe for cats as well, that's even available over the counter. So using both of, either of those products would be fine.
In terms of the weight?
You have to know what the cats weigh because there's different. The weight, you can use it right away. Absolutely no problem. She could put it on today. So, but make sure you're using the right size product for the cat as well. And there's different sizes too. So if you've got a group of cats, don't just assume that they're all around the same weight.
All right. So weight and W-A-I-T.
Yes. Okay.
My 8-year-old is working on those words and spelling as a matter of fact.
Get them treated right now and make sure that if they're inside vacuuming the house really well, and you need to treat for minimum of 3 months to be able to break that life cycle, all the eggs and larvae and cocoons in the environment, you have to treat for that long period of time to be able to get it under control.
Julia in Fox Cities. Hi to you. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I have two quick questions. One is we adopted a poodle mix from the shelter, and he's been a great, wonderful dog. 6 months after we got him, he developed sebaceous adenitis.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're doing right now is bathing him once a week with some exfoliating shampoo and then putting mineral oil in on him and really rubbing it in, and then taking Dawn liquid detergent to wash off the mineral oil. And is there anything else we can do? That helps, but he's still developing, you know, some of those secondary skin dermatitis. And then my second question is about depression. And dogs, is there such a thing? And if I get another companion for him from the shelter, would that help? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank
you. Okay. Well, let's answer the dog depression question first. You get another dog because you want another dog. It's really hard to say whether he would appreciate having another being in the house. And yeah, dogs can develop depression sometimes after they've lost a housemate, or there's been some big change in the family schedule or makeup. Those, you know, we'll see a dog just even their schedule's been thrown off, kind of go into a funk. And I think the big thing is, you know, exercise, stick to a schedule that works for both you and your dog. You know, maybe consider seeing how your dog does mentally by taking it to doggy daycare for a couple of days a week and just see, is your dog happier after having a day of being able to interact and play with other dogs? Obviously, your dog would have to be socialized and healthy and, you know, not having any external parasites or internal parasites. So there's a little bit of footwork to go through before you can take your dog into doggy daycare. But I'd give that a try before you think about adding another dog for your dog. Add one because you want another one. When it comes to sebaceous adenitis, this is a inherited poodle type problem where they develop inflammatory changes in the sebaceous glands in their skin, and it can be quite debilitating for the dog. It's something that is diagnosed via biopsying, and good poodle breeders will be biopsying their dog to watch for changes of it periodically. And it's a tough disease to have to get under control. To be honest with you, I have never treated a dog with sebaceous adenitis, so the actual mechanism of getting it under control, I would have to defer to my dermatologist crew at the veterinary school. And just like the neurology department, we do have a couple of dermatologists on staff with their residents as well. And that would be something that you may want to consider looking into. My guess is the fact that it's a inflammatory type change, you may be looking at using some type of an anti-inflammatory medication to get under control, rather than just using, you know, shampoos and things to be able to make the dog's body surface looks better. This is actually a problem in the skin, not on the skin. So you may be looking at systemic drugs. And again, I think talking to a veterinary dermatologist would be in your best interest.
All right. And on to Sarah in Madison. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Dr. Sawtek. My question regards catney or cat acne, mm-hmm. as they call it. We have three cats, two adults and a kitten, and our one adult cat, who I should mention is all white. She's seven, and she seems to go through really bad stages of this black bacteria buildup under her chin and around her face, and I'm wondering if that's an indicator of something more serious, or if you could maybe enlighten us as to how we might better treat it.
Yeah, it's very common for cats to get chin acne. We don't particularly know why some cats are more prone to it than others. It's not a teenager disease or a hormonal change disease or anything like that. It just shows up. Some of the theories of why they develop it, and I you know, don't know how true these are. You'll see people say use stainless steel bowls or ceramic bowls that get washed daily rather than plastic bowls, making sure that you know, you do keep the chin area clean, so using like some antibacterial soap on it. Most of these, if you start doing cytology, you're going to find have a bacterial component, and some of them will have a yeast component as well. And so treating both of those types of infection, either topically or systemically, may be in order. For cats that end up with cystic acne, where their chin becomes swollen and they get oozy, you know, big pimples on their chin, then you're looking at obvious going with systemic drugs. Treating topically is not going to cut it for these guys. But try the change in the composition of the bowl. Make sure you're washing the bowls all the time. Maybe consider getting a little pair of hair clippers and keep the hair trim short so that you can keep the chin scrubbed and clean on a regular basis. Be really careful with what you use for scrubbing the chin. There are some really nice, safe, like medicated pads, but don't use human acne products. They're too harsh for cat skin. So, you know, avoid the human stuff. Talk to your veterinarian and get some topical things that may help keep the grease and bacteria and yeast under control as well.
There you go.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. An email from Dan. My six-month-old golden doodle gets car sick every time we take a ride. Can we give her something prior to a trip or any tips to help her? Might she grow out of it?
Some dogs do. And I experiment, first of all, with not feeding her before you put her in the car. Maybe look at the location that you have your dog, such as, you know, is she, you know, just roaming around free in the back seat, or does she do better if she's seatbelted in or in a crate with a cover over it so that it's facing forward? Mm-hmm. So you may want to play with things like that, just kind of like they do with kids, you know, so they have to look out the front of the car rather than seeing the world whizzing by on the sides. There are medications that you can use. There is a prescription product called Serenia that is used once a day, works very, very effectively. Effectively, not sedating, great for dogs that have travel issues with being nauseated. Over-the-counter products like Bonine and Dramamine and those types of things work as well, but they can be sedating. So you have to look at where, how long are you traveling for, where are you going. If you're going to be having to sedate her to get her to dog training class, obviously, you know, that's going to be a big issue for her. So your veterinarian would be able to get you some of this product called Serenia. And, you know, that's my go-to product right now, is I have owners have that on hand.
Bob in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Bob.
Good morning.
What can we do for you?
Yes, I've got a 13-year-old male cat neutered that is marking in the house. We have another female cat, though, in the house, and that doesn't seem to be the problem. The problem started when a feral cat was marking on the outside of our house. Now our cat is marking on a table downstairs that is covered with plastic. Okay. Our vet clinic has been trying very hard. We've tried different feeds, medications for urinary tract infections. We've had it's happened during and after the medication, so we just don't know what to do anymore.
Yeah, is your cat actually like hitting like the table legs and things with urine, or is it, you know, squatting on the top of the table?
On top of the table, on some plastic where it already had marked underneath the plastic.
Okay.
So
I always wonder, is it really marking behavior? When cats are marking, they're the typical stance that they have is they're standing up. They have their tail up in the air, their tail's quivering, they're prancing on their back legs, and a horizontal stream of urine comes out and hits a vertical object, a wall, a table leg, a sofa, an arm of a sofa. If he's squatting on top of the table, I wonder if it, you know, it truly is marking, or, you know, is this just inappropriate elimination? 13-year-old cat that starts doing this, you really need to jump through some hoops and do a really thorough medical workup. Make sure that your kitty doesn't have any chronic kidney issues, that your cat is not hyperthyroid, so getting some blood work done. Those are all really important things to be able to rule out first. And then I'd also be looking at, you know, if you've got two cats, your veterinarian should be sitting down with you and looking at the environment that you have for them regarding their toilet facilities, making sure that you have a minimum of at least three litter boxes in three separate locations in your home. If your cat really likes that area where the table is, providing them with a easy access litter box. In this case, a 13-year-old cat, I would go with one that you can either cut down one of the sides so they can get in. Sometimes kitties that age have a little arthritis, and using a soft, scoopable, sandy litter, no cover on the box, keeping it clean. That type of thing.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's been addressed or not, but definitely, you know, would need to be. Sometimes things that our medical problems turn into behavior problems. They start enjoying going in a certain preference, you know, a certain area, location preference. There may be, they may develop a surface preference. Do you have a litter box in that area? Did you?
We have three litter boxes, and one does not have a lid on it, and they are all in the basement within 20 feet of this pool table. So,
okay.
It's kept very clean.
It
stays on the table. It does not go off the table at all, so he's doing it in a squat.
Yeah, so, you know, I think your veterinarian was wise to start looking at, you know, does your cat have some underlying urinary issue? It's uncommon for cats to get kidney or bladder infections unless they have some underlying medical problem like kidney failure or diabetes or something. So I'd go back to the drawing board and say, you know, you've got litter boxes with two covers on it. Maybe we need to be, you know, adding in extra ones, or maybe even, I know it sounds kind of gross, but putting a litter box, if it's a pool table, it's big enough to be able to have a litter box on it, actually giving him a litter box up there so that he starts using that, and then you can gradually move it to someplace else.
Okay, mm-hmm. We'll try that. Very good.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Kathy in Prairie du Sac. On to you now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Dr. Sawchuk.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I have a mini schnauzer. He's actually a mini schnauzer mix. He has Bichon in him, and he developed skin allergies several years ago. They mm-hmm. got progressively worse, which is not uncommon, and he is now on cyclosporin,
mm-hmm.
and it works really well for him. My only question is that it's an immune system depressant, and I was just wondering, is that one of the reasons why he might develop warts, or is it likely that exposure to warts, you'll see more of them on the dog?
No.
And then I had another quick question after that.
Okay. Dogs can get papillomas or warts. They're
right.
Usually in the mouth. It's typically a young dog disease. They go to the dog park. They share a ball or a stick with another dog that has a wart in their mouth, and there's saliva transmitted. It's not uncommon for dogs to, when they get older, to get little skin tags and sebaceous adenomas and other things on their skin that people will call warts, but they're really not warts. They're benign skin growths. So, you can biopsy them to be able to tell the difference. Sometimes it's just the appearance of them that makes it, you know, the veterinarian can look at one over the other to see what the difference is. But cyclosporine, we're using it at, it's a drug that suppresses the immune system. But it's at very low levels. It is a drug that is used at high levels for things like organ transplants. We'll use it in kitties that have had kidney transplants. In dogs, it's usually at a pretty low level. And for most dogs that go on cyclosporine, you can even get them down to usually every other day dose, or sometimes even a couple of times a week. We'll keep their skin allergies under control. The biggest side effect that I've seen is a problem where you get changes in the gum tissue. It's called gingival hyperplasia, where their gum tissue becomes more prolific, and it can create some pockets and things where they can develop periodontal disease as a result of it. So it may mean, an extra visit to your veterinarian periodically for dental hygiene issues and getting those teeth cleaned.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I have an email from Sandy in Fox Lake. My golden doodle has been experiencing a variety of problems, hyperthyroidism, bladder infection, coccidiosis. Since treating her with the appropriate medication, she's lost her appetite. Been trying fresh cooked chicken, eggs, hamburger, and rice. After eating these for several days, she loses interest. She's not been eating her favorite kibble food either. I have changed the kibble with the same results.
Oh, my goodness. Well, hypothyroidism is a common hormonal problem that does affect a number of breeds of dogs, and golden retrievers happen to be one of them that we see a lot of this in. I would expect that if that is being treated appropriately, that drug does not cause any appetite suppression or issues. So, but they can have a sluggish appetite when they are hypothyroid. So making sure that the thyroid level's normal, that she's on the right dose of the medication for that. Antibiotics, if she did have a bladder infection and was treated with antibiotics, that can affect the gut flora and sometimes will put dogs on a probiotic, which is a safe bacteria. In the human world, there's a product called Fluorigen. In the dog world, we'll use Fortiflora, or there's another one called Prostora that the Iams company makes. And there's several others out there on the market as well to help keep the gut inoculated with the appropriate bacteria. But again, typically that doesn't cause a whole lot of appetite change. It may affect the stool quality where their stool's a little bit softer, but it shouldn't affect their appetite to that degree. Coccidiosis, again, it's a coccidia. There's several different types out there. The great majority of adult dogs that are passing coccidia, it's usually a species called Imeria, which just means that they've been going out and eating, you know, wild stool from wildlife. And it's not a dog parasite. It just goes in one end and out the other. And so it's sometimes seen on a fecal examination, usually doesn't require treatment. The dog coccidia that dogs can get is called Isospora. And it's up to your veterinarian when they're running the stool check to be able to differentiate between those two species. And again, most adult dogs, if they shed the odd Isospora, you don't have to treat them. It's a self-limiting disease. The only time we treat is if they are running into issues with having diarrhea or, you know, and so that, again, is the dog's appetite because the dog has coccidiosis. Treatment for that is using a couple of different drugs, either a sulfa antibiotic or there's a large animal, a horse product called Panaziril that's being used as well off-label that seems to be very effective too. So I think it's time to go back to the drawing board because I don't think any of those diseases are probably bad enough to cause your dog to be as inappetent as you're describing.
Catherine in West Bend, we turn to you now. Hi, Catherine. Thanks for calling. Catherine, are you there? Ah, we must have lost her. Let's go to Stephanie in Milwaukee then. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I was talking to my sister last night, and she has a dog. It's a yellow lab beagle mix. And since he was a puppy, they diagnosed him early on with allergy. And so he's about 8 years old now, and someone mentioned to her that maybe it could be thyroid. They tried all sorts of medications and diet changes, and the only thing that seems to work for him is prednisone, and they can't get him off the prednisone. The symptoms just return automatically.
Okay.
And the other thing she's noticing is that he has a very strong odor, body odor.
Yeah, yeah. Prednisone, although it is very effective at suppressing the immune system, and so for dogs with allergies, it can stop the itch. Long-term side effects just are horrible with that particular drug. It can suppress the adrenal glands. It can thin the skin. It can predispose them to skin infections. So just like the last caller had a question regarding using cyclosporine and the side effects of that for treating a dog with allergies, that is the drug that if we're looking at needing something to suppress the immune system for long-term control, that's our go-to drug right now. I wonder if some of the dog's skin issues too, maybe the dog has allergies, but if there's a body odor, the dog may have a secondary skin infection. So they may be walking around with either a bacterial infection, a yeast infection. And so when I get one of these cases in, I'll look between the toes. I'll look underneath the pads of the feet. I'll take cytology samples from there. I'll, you know, look in all the skin folds and so on. And it's a pretty long involved appointment to be able to look at all those key body parts to be able to see is there an infection someplace? Because the infection itself can be driving the itch too. So get the infections tested out for, treat them if necessary, be looking at switching the dog from prednisone to something safer like cyclosporine, and then also be looking at maybe a visit to a veterinary dermatologist for allergy testing so that you can maybe get to the bottom of what your dog's allergic to and either eliminate it from their environment or go through some allergy shots to be able to desensitize the dog to the allergens in the environment.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. There we go. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking Your Pet's Health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. Give us a call with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org or go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or comment or even a photo right there. Catherine in West Bend, we turn to you now. Hi, Catherine.
Hi there. To both of you, I'm calling about two cats that we adopted very recently from the Humane Society. They've both lived together for 5 years, so they're very familiar with each other. When we brought them home, the one with long hair that they told us was part Maine Coon cat started scratching his ears, and it got worse and worse, and by the time we got them in for the regular vet checkup, the bases of his ears were bloody.
Oh, my goodness.
And the doctor treated it with myconazole, although he did not see any ringworm there. He said he'd treat it with that. That didn't help. In fact, the cat seemed to be kind of lethargic and not doing real well with the myconazole. So I stopped the myconazole. It seems to have gotten a little bit better. But a friend whose cat had similar symptoms said that her cat apparently had allergies and was treated with, like prednisone. Anyway, so, and someone else said that they've heard of cats being treated with Benadryl or something like that for allergies.
Yeah, Benadryl doesn't work very well for cats. I mean, it is sedating. It can make some cats will fight it and they become a little wiggy on it. And I've just not been real impressed with using antihistamines for dealing with allergies. If the only place the cat's itchy is on the head, it still could be allergies. And, you know, animals present different ways. I would hope that the veterinarian look down in the ears to make sure that there isn't anything there that could be triggering the itch. They just got out of a shelter, so we worry about things like parasitic diseases like ear mites. So even though this is the only cat that's scratching, I've seen some cats with raging ear mites and they never lift a paw to their ear. I don't know why, but they just aren't bothered by them. It's kind of like, you know, me getting a mosquito bite, I'm going to itch like mad, whereas other people, you know, they don't react at all. So having a good look in the ears, collecting material from the ears to be able to look under the microscope for doing either a mite check, which is one type of microscope slide made, and then you'd also look for evidence of infection for bacteria and yeast, and then be looking at, you know, does your cat have secondary infection around the head? If they've been scratching long enough to be able to break the skin, you know, is there bacteria there? Is, you know, and so getting some cytology of that area and, you know, putting a little slide up to it and collecting some of the skin cells and having a look under the microscope would be helpful as well. So I think you need to get to a diagnosis before you start looking at treatment, because ear mites are treated one way, allergies can be treated another way, skin infections are treated a different way. And sometimes if we find that it's just allergies, we can use, if it's just around the ears, topical steroids. Usually our pharmacist will make up some dexamethasone ear drops, and we instill those in the ear. Sometimes we start out twice a day and then gradually taper down. But that would be something that after diagnosis that potentially could be used. But I'd rule out those other things first.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. We have an email from Michael. I have two indoor cats that occasionally are taken for walks on our yard on a leash, but otherwise are 100% indoor. Is it advisable to administer heartworm if they do not spend much time outdoors?
Well, cats get heartworm at about 5 to 20% of the rate that dogs do. So, you know, if you're going out in the middle of the day when mosquitoes are low, it's probably pretty low risk. The biggest thing that I'd be more concerned about would be exposure to the soil and picking up intestinal parasites as they, you know, groom their feet when they get home. The other thing would be flea exposure or tick exposure. And the nice thing for cats is there is a product that is called Revolution, that gets heartworm as well as getting fleas and intestinal parasites. There's another one called Advantage Multi that can be used in cats as well. In fact, that's what I'm using in my cats right now. And that does the same thing as well. They're both prescription products. You'd have to get them from your veterinarian. But, you know, I'd be more concerned about bringing in the creepy crawlies and the fleas. And so yeah, if you can do both things at once, great. Let's do it.
Mary Jo emailed from Wausau. A couple of times a day, I find our 18-month-old Australian Shepherd in a sitting position, pulling himself along by his front paws on the carpet or grass, depending on where he's at, almost like he's wiping himself.
Yep.
We've all seen that. What does this indicate?
Oh, the little butt scoot. Yes. Okay. Yeah. So when dogs scoot like that, it indicates that their butt's itchy. Okay. So what could be causing it? It may be that he is having a little fecal residue. Figures lunchtime. Oh, it's okay. We get this call. Little fecal residue back there, and he's just learned that it feels better to be able to get it off. So if he has diarrhea or any, you know, issues with his stool, you need to address that. We'll also see dogs itch when they have skin conditions around their rectum. So, you know, be on the lookout to make sure that there isn't any hair loss, redness, or anything that could be bugging him. Tapeworms are another reason for dogs to itch back there. Tapeworms are a parasite that live in the intestinal tract and will shed little pieces, little segments that move, and they crawl out independently of the fecal material or on the surface of the stool. And so they're coming out and maybe causing your dog to itch back there. So, you know, start watching your dog's, the surface of your dog's stool when they have a BM, and have a look around in his bedding to look for things that look like little pieces of rice. Because they're hard to find on a routine stool check. It's often owners visualizing them to bring it to our attention. And then lastly, our impacted anal glands. And that would be something that your veterinarian, probably they don't want to do it, but we have to do it. It's part of our job, doing a rectal exam and expressing those anal glands and seeing if they're full. So those are some things that you can be looking at.
All right. On to Cheryl in Merrimack. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Very good. Thank you for calling.
Oh, yeah. It's a pleasure to call you. We have a soft-coated Wheaton Terrier. He's about 4 years old, and he weighs about 40 pounds. And Sunday night, he had a real hard time going to sleep. And he normally he goes down real easily, and it was like he was on caffeine. You know, it was like he would try to settle and then pop up, that sort of thing. And I remember this happening one other time about a month ago, and I started thinking about it, and I wondered whether it had anything to do with the over-the-counter flea and tick medicine that I'm putting on him, because that happened earlier in the day with both incidents. He doesn't have it any other time. And I'm wondering if that is somehow getting into his system and keeping him awake. It's just for one night, and then he's fine.
And it may not be that it's getting into his system. It could be that it's causing some local irritation. By far, that's one of the most common, although not very common, but when you look at reported side effects, you'll see sometimes skin irritation at the application spot. So, you know, that it may be that either the odor's bugging him, the feel of it's bugging him, or it is causing some skin irritation. I'm not sure which product you're using, but again, if it's an over-the-counter product, take the box into your veterinarian and say, can I find me something different that doesn't contain this carrier, this particular drug, and they hopefully would be able to help you and provide your dog with something else for flea and tick control. Remember, we're heading into right now the big deer tick season. This is the time of the year where deer ticks are starting to wake up, and come October, November, boy, that's when they really are out there. So just because it's getting a little cool out doesn't mean you have to stop using your flea and tick preventative.
There you go.
Thanks very much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Betsy and Ripon, on to you now. Hi, Betsy.
Hi. I would like to know what's the difference between using Advantix, and I might have a number after it, and also, or Frontline.
Okay. They are both flea and tick preparations. Frontline is what you're going to find is Frontline Plus, which has not only fipronil, which kills fleas and ticks, but also helps prevent flea eggs from being able to develop because it has another chemical in it that is an insect growth regulator. So that's frontline, not absorbed systemically. It stays on the surface of the body, gets down into the hair follicles, and coats the hairs as it travels up, and that's what the insects are coming into contact with. Advantix is a combination of two different preparations. It's imidacloprid, which is a chemical that controls fleas, and then they've added in permethrin, which is a flea and tick product, but primarily used for its tick efficacy. And because there's permethrin in it, Advantix is also labeled for helping to control mosquitoes. And so dogs that are in really heavy mosquito-infested areas, it may help with keeping them a little more comfortable by using that particular product. Frontline is not labeled for repelling mosquitoes. So there you go. Two different things, different chemicals, do roughly the same thing, but not exactly.
Which one would you recommend?
It really depends on where you live and, you know, what I happen to like Frontline. If I had to pick a product, I like it. My beef with permethrin-based products, and I know I'm going to be getting some flack from the company for saying this, is that if even though this is a product only labeled for dog use, I just having it in the hands of an owner that may inadvertently put it on their cat or have a cat that cuddles up to the dog and sleeps close with them. If I'm using Advantix, I will tell people to isolate the dog from another dog or the cat so there's no licking or transmission of the chemical from one to the other until the spot is dry. So good idea, put it on at night, have the dog sleep in their kennel or in a room by themselves before you start letting them mingle. And I always, you know, just always wonder about, you know, because it can be passed through the skin. Is there any risk for human toxicosis? And I mean, obviously that's been looked at, and you know, they tell you don't touch the spot until it's dry. But you know, I have my gut feeling about kids and stuff. You know, there's a wet spot on the dog, they're gonna touch it. So I think Advantix works really well. It's just for me not my preferred product. But what did I use on my dog this month? Advantix. Why? Because I got a free sample. So this stuff's expensive. And so I ended up using that on my dogs. But I don't have young kids. My dogs and cats don't commingle. I made sure they got the right dose and it was applied appropriately. So, I was careful. But I always wonder about what's going to happen once it's in the hand of the consumer.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today. She'll be with us right up until 12:30 here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. And if you are like me, the animals that are part of your family are important to you and you want to keep them healthy and happy. And that's why we're glad to have Dr. Sandy Sawchuk with us from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. She's here for the next half hour to share new information and timely advice. And whether you're a lifelong pet owner or maybe you're new to sharing your home with animals, she's ready to answer your questions when you call in, for example. You can do that at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And don't forget to check our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show for updates, for news, and photos. We got some great photos up. If you like it, if you click like it while you're there, you'll get regular updates on upcoming show topics. Hope you'll stay tuned. We'll be back right after this look at the news. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her here, and thank you so much for listening in. Lots of callers online. All the lines are filled, so we'll just go right away to Gloria in Waukesha. Gloria, hello.
Hi, I have a 3-year-old Yorkie.
Okay.
And we have to start sending him to, when we go away, we put him in daycare.
Mm-hmm.
And the 3 times we've put him in daycare, he's come home with a cough.
And it happens like that evening, he's coughing? Or has it happened a few days after he's been there?
A few days after.
A few days after, okay. couple things that I get concerned about. Anytime we've got a dog with a cough, especially Yorkies, make sure that he doesn't have like a collapsing trachea, that, his respiratory system is absolutely normal. And that would be something your veterinarian can do on physical exam or maybe even taking an x-ray. But when we put a dog in with a group of dogs, it's not uncommon for them to develop kennel cough, which is, it's not one particular disease. It's a whole group of bacteria and viruses. Probably the most common one that everyone hears about is Bordetella. But there's parainfluenza, there's dog herpes, and there's even canine influenza, which is kind of the new bug on the street too that dogs can get, but they're usually pretty sick with that. So, you know, I'm wondering if your dog, I mean, one, if they haven't been vaccinated for kennel cough prior to going to the kennel, they should. The kennel cough vaccine typically only protects for a couple of types of the diseases that cause kennel cough. And so, you know, you still have that risk of picking up other things too. But check with your veterinarian to make sure that that has been done. If it hasn't, get it done before you go into the boarding kennel the next time.
Mm-hmm. Well, he has had the kennel cough vaccine.
Okay. All right. So it may be that he's picked up herpes, or he's picked up, dog influenza, or a mycoplasma, or some of the other bugs that are contagious as well that we don't have vaccines for. And this is the dilemma that we have, is how far do you go with getting a diagnosis? Should you be doing x-rays and tracheal washes and cultures and cytology if it's something that the dog is feeling okay and just coughing? I have had some dogs that have gone into a kennel and they just spend so much time barking and panting and running around that then they come home and they're hoarse and they have a little bit of a sore throat just from all the activity there. So it doesn't sound like that's what's going on since it happens a few days later. But check and make sure that your dog does have normal airway, because that may be why your dog is predisposed to picking something up.
Okay. There you go. Thank you very much for calling, Gloria. Appreciate it. Catherine in Milwaukee, on to you. Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have three questions. I'll try to make them as quick as possible. The first is, we have a collie mix. We got him from the Humane Society in Milwaukee about a little over a year ago, and he was 3 months at the time. And about 2 weeks ago, we noticed that he was itching and itching and itching all over his paws, his ears, to the point where he was itching his face. He's made himself bleed. So we took him in, and the vet said he has seasonal allergies, and they're really not getting better. So we took him back yesterday. They have prescribed Claritin, and we also bathe him once a week with a medicated shampoo that they gave us. But it's really not getting better, and we're wondering if it might be his food, because about a month ago, he's transitioned from the puppy, it's the same brand, but from the puppy to the adult.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my first question. The second question is, at the same time we took him in for the allergies, he had his 3-year rabies vaccine,
mm-hmm.
and he's developed a pretty sizable lump in the area where he had the vaccine. So we called and they told us to bring him in yesterday, and we did, and she measured it and she said it was about a centimeter and that we should just keep watching it. Well, we're pretty concerned about it. It doesn't seem to bother him, but it seems to be, it's definitely gotten bigger since, you know, the initial vaccine.
Okay, well, let me answer those questions because my brain's going to forget. Okay,
okay,
so
okay,
sorry.
Good.
But the first question regarding food allergies and whether it could potentially be food, I just saw in the paper the Madison area, or I don't know if it's Madison area or Wisconsin in general, but we are in the top 10 for the worst allergies in the country. And so that was just in the news this morning. And
seasonal
allergies. Okay. Yeah, yeah. So this is a bad year for
last year. I'm sorry, Dan. Yeah. He didn't have them last year, so that's why we were wondering. But
and it's not uncommon for dogs to have very mild symptoms 1 year, and then every year it gradually gets worse, and it's possible that it's just he's sensitized to something now. And so the fact that it started this time of the year, this is like the peak of allergy season right now. And, you know, I keep harping on this, but usually antihistamines are not going to do a whole lot for the dog. You can try them, but you typically need to either be looking at a short-term round of steroids to kind of break the itch, cyclosporine, topical steroids applied to certain body parts like feet and ears and so on are a nice safe alternative. treat the secondary infections. You know, maybe a fish oil supplement. Sometimes that helps with the inflammatory response. Whole host of things that you can do, but it comes down to, you know, what's he allergic to? And your question is to food. We do see dogs developing food allergies. Unfortunately, there isn't a really good test for food allergies except an elimination diet trial. And by that, I mean feeding him a novel protein and carbohydrate source that he's never had. And unfortunately, most dogs have helped themselves to people food. Most pet foods are going to have a variety of protein and carbohydrate sources in it. You know, treats that you're giving are going to offer some things. And so when we're putting a dog on a hypoallergenic diet, it's usually a therapeutic diet that's a hydrolyzed protein diet. And, you know, we put them on that for 6 to 8 weeks. They don't even get their normal oral heartworm preventative because that's beef flavored. And so we want nothing. They get that and water, and we see if they get better. And if they do, then you can either keep them on that particular diet or gradually start introducing different allergens. So you can have a chicken week or a tofu week or a beef week and see what he's allergic to. And rarely ever the grains. It's usually the protein in the diet that's the big problem. So, you know, to think about talking to your veterinarian about doing that.
Okay.
And I'd say, you know, if he's still itchy, you've got to up the ante because you don't want him to mutilate himself and get secondary infections.
We're not comfortable with the steroids. Is there something else? I mean, we're just afraid of side effects.
If you can use them topically, okay. that would be a good way to get around it. Again, even if you're using them topically, long term, they can get absorbed and cause problems. But we're just looking at putting the fire out. So when I get a dog in that's really, really bad, sometimes I'll just use a week or two of some prednisone. Nothing long term, just a very short term burst of it, just to make the dog feel more comfortable, to kind of break that itch scratch cycle. And then, you know, maybe you'll have some better luck with antihistamines and things like that too. So, yeah, your question
I was just going to say, what about the rabies?
The rabies vaccine, yeah. Rabies vaccine for dogs is a killed vaccine. It's not a live organism. And so to get the immune response to be able to produce antibodies to rabies and develop the protection, they have to put various ingredients in the vaccine that are called adjuvants. They're basically irritants that irritate the tissue to cause the immune response to, you know, drive cells in, and they go, oh, look, here is a rabies virus, and they'll start to produce antibodies to the rabies. The reason why we can't use a live vaccine like a distemper vaccine is because it could cause rabies, and we don't want to have a vaccine revert to its natural state and actually put the dog's health at risk and our health at risk. So back years ago, we had this available, a modified live rabies vaccine, but that got pulled off the market in the early 80s. So all we have is killed vaccines. They're irritating. They almost all always cause a lump. And so when I vaccinate a dog for rabies, I always give it in the right rear leg. And I tell the owner, don't be surprised if they get a lump. If it's not painful, it's small, it's not hot, it's, you know, it doesn't bother the dog, it may take 3 or 4 weeks to go away. Cats, different story. They develop a lump. We're really got to be careful watching them. Cats can develop sarcomas or a malignant tissue tumor that can be quite aggressive. And so we really are careful with either not using the killed vaccine that is available for dogs and cats. There's a special cat vaccine, but we don't have that one available for dogs. So you're stuck with maybe your dog getting local reactions. So hopefully they can get onto an every 3 year schedule and you don't have to put up with this every year.
Mm-hmm. Good luck.
And then, thank you. Can I ask my third one real quick?
Real quick.
Okay. The third one is a little bit different. We also have a 3-month baby, and our dog loves to lick her in the face and on the feet. And my husband keeps telling me not to worry about it, but I do worry about the transfer of germs. Is that something I should be concerned about?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, I mean, dogs lick their privates. They drink out of the toilet. They don't discriminate between eating dead things outside. So, and because they don't brush their teeth every day, their mouth may be filled with bacteria. In reality, though, probably your kid is at, your baby, I should say, is more at risk from you kissing them than the dog, because you carry diseases that can be transmitted to your child, various viruses and things. So I don't want you to not kiss your child, but, you know, I think that licking the baby's feet, if there's no open sores, probably not a big deal. I would keep the dog away from the face, though. I think that I'd draw the line at that. So just
there
because
you
never know what's been in their mouth.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Catherine. Viola in Shawano, on to you now. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It's a comment. It's about that lady that called in about her dog having thyroid problems.
Mm-hmm.
I give my dog a canine thyroid support. It's all natural. It's made here in Wisconsin at the Standard Process Incorporated.
Mm-hmm.
Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. We're losing her, but I think I can make some comments on this. Yes, and that is something that can be used often along with a thyroid supplement. It's very uncommon to have that supplement by itself provide all the support that the dog needs. But I think that using it along with a synthetic thyroid product, to make sure that the dog's thyroid levels are up to normal, would be just fine. So yes, I can't remember what she just said, and my brain just went, but natural process? No, sorry, I can't remember, but it's thyroid support. You could probably just Google that for dogs, and that product will come up. Yep.
Sorry, we lost you there, Viola. Linda and Eau Claire will turn to you then. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I have a 1.5-year-old boxer who has developed those little skin tags around his mouth. Is what I thought they were until I started listening to your program. Somebody called in about those. They kind of look like warts, but now he started with two on the outside of his lip.
Mm-hmm.
Now he has one under his chin.
Mm-hmm.
They look like skin tags, but looking at them closer now, they are starting to get a little head on them.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering what I should do. Should I take him to the vet? Should I continue to monitor them?
I mean, I think that it's always a good idea to get a diagnosis. If your dog truly does have the canine papilloma virus and warts, you would not probably be wanting to take your dog to doggy daycare. You would want to avoid dog parks until they go away because your dog would be contagious to other dogs.
Okay.
And so I think it's a good idea to get a diagnosis. Warts kind of, if you look at them, they have kind of little fingers of tissue coming out, little tiny fronds, if you want to call it that. We had a dog in this year at the vet school that ended up with so many warts. I have never seen a case like this. Hundreds and hundreds all around the dog's mouth. They ended up having to do, laser surgery to try to cut back on the numbers because the dog could barely eat or swallow. And so some wart conditions can really, really be bad. Typically, dogs get two or three of them and they go away on their own, but it can take several weeks, kind of like us getting a wart. It is contagious to other people. So got to be careful.
So I have another dog.
Okay.
So
it's possible if your other dog is an older dog, they may have had one and you didn't even know they got it and they developed immunity and they are not going to become symptomatic. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of like a rite of passage. How many people do you know that have never had a wart before? Almost all of us have had one at least sometime in our life.
Yep.
And it's just, as your immune system responds, you may never get them again.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. And Robert in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Robert.
Good afternoon, Larry. Hello, Doc. I have a question concerning tea consumption in dogs, specifically oolong and green tea. I know a number of dogs who seem to have a very great affinity for these teas.
Okay. I'd be really concerned about the caffeine content. I don't know how much caffeine is in either of those, but any, tea, coffee, chocolate, the caffeine, theobromine, any of those are really potent stimulants for dogs. We tend to tolerate it very well, but dogs don't. They just don't handle it. And we can see them becoming not only, just agitated, but, as it progresses, depending on the dose, it can lead to death. So this is why we always harp, keep the chocolate away from the dogs, because, too much of a good thing is going to cause them problems. So not being a green tea connoisseur, I don't know the caffeine content in it.
I don't either.
I don't either.
It varies from tea to tea depending on the type of leaf and
yeah. So you gotta be careful.
I would keep it away from them.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you for calling. We had an email from let's see, who's it from? From Jane in Suring. It's not financially or because of where she lives practical for her to take her dogs to the vet every time one of them seems a little off. I know of a couple of people whose dogs received frontline according to directions and still got anaplasmosis. Is there a website or other resource that I can go to get good detailed information on symptoms and possible causes so that I can better judge when the dog needs to see the vet, hopefully prevents more serious problems from waiting too long.
Yeah. So I think we've got two separate questions here. The one is, what resources could she use to evaluate, look up symptoms that her dog may have? And, I think there's a couple of good books that I'm going to recommend. I think every pet owner should probably have a Merck manual for pet health. It's readily available. You can also get the veterinary version, but it's written for veterinarians, but they do make one for pet owners as well. There's a really good book by a person named Chris Pinney, and it's called The Complete Home Veterinary Guide. The nice thing about that is it's divided up into chapters on lots of different things for the, responsible pet owner to read through. But it also gives really good advice about when to seek professional help. So they talk about the symptoms, what to be looking for, and they'll point right out, if your dog's showing these signs, get into the vet right away. So that might be one to be able to have on hand as well. The third book that I like is the Angel Memorial Animal Hospital book. Angel Memorial is a veterinary hospital out on the East Coast. It was published about 6-8 years ago, but still a goodie. So that would be another one to, ask for Christmas to keep your dogs healthy. But the other question is, why did this dog that's getting frontline pick up anaplasma? Well, anaplasma is a tick-borne disease spread by the deer tick. And my theory is, I have two. One is that owners are not using the product when they should be. I have seen ticks out in February with, we have weather in the 40s and snow on the ground and grass blades poking up. And I've seen ticks questing in the snow. Okay. If you get temperatures above 40, they will come up. And so how many people in Wisconsin use tick control in February? Not very many. And so we have breaks in treatment, and that's how they end up getting it, is by not using the product. We are now heading into our major tick season right now for deer ticks. It's spring, early spring, and late into the fall. And until we get a good snow covering, you need to have your pet on some type of flea and tick preventative. Big issue with ticks is that their biology is very different than fleas. Fleas are really easy to kill. They jump up on the pet and they run all over the place. And so they have lots of contact with the chemical because they're moving all over the pet's body. And so whatever you've applied, they're going to come in contact with it eventually and die. Ticks climb on board and just sit there. They are like, I'm on my dinner table. I'm going to start feeding. And so they don't move around and they're not going to have a lot of contact with the hair that, or the skin that contains the chemical, because they're just in one spot feeding. So that's where this new product that the Mariel company has come out with called Certifact comes into play. This little bit of this chemical called Amitraz makes the ticks move around. And so when you actually watch videos of ticks that are exposed to this, they start doing a little dance and they're running through the hair coat. So they're acting more like fleas. They're picking up the chemical and they die a lot faster. So if you're in a heavy tick area, use CertiFect and maybe consider using it year-round. Maybe January, you don't have to, but boy, unless you're really good at predicting the weather, you're looking at almost year-round tick control.
We have an email from Laura of Golden Retriever. She has a growth about an inch below her eye. I've taken her to the vet where they did a biopsy, said it was a blood blister. It's getting bigger and harder. What, if anything, should I do?
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't know how they did a biopsy. If it is getting bigger, it may be that they introduced some secondary infection. Or if we have, some of the little skin tumors, like the cutaneous blood vessel tumors like hemangiosarcoma or hemangiomas can sometimes be hard to diagnose because you, instead of getting cancer cells, all you get is blood. So if it's bothering the dog, rather than just putting a needle in and try to get a diagnosis, it may be time to say, let's just get the whole thing off and send it in for analysis to make sure we are dealing with something benign rather than something malignant.
Yeah, makes good sense. Debbie and Baraboo, hello to you.
Hello. I have a question regarding the AAHA vaccination protocol.
Uh-huh.
The information I have is from 2006, and I was just wondering if you could give me an update on which ones are considered core vaccines and which are non-core.
Oh, real quick. I'll do this really quick. They're coming out with new guidelines. They should have been out in 2010. It looks like it's not even going to happen in 2011, but this is the American Animal Hospital Association's vaccine guidelines for dogs. Core vaccines for dogs are distemper, adenovirus 2, parvovirus, and rabies. That's it. Okay. Those are the core vaccines. The big changes that they're going to be making is if dogs are being vaccinated for leptospirosis, it should not be used as a combination vaccine with any other vaccines. It needs to be given as a separate vaccine. It can be given at the same vaccine appointment, but just in a separate location on the dog's body, not mixed together. That seems to be what's driving a lot of vaccine reactions. So it's a great spot for owners to go so that they can be the advocate for their dog when they're going in to get their dogs vaccinated.
And thank you very much for calling. And Sandy, thank you so much. You'll be back.
Sometime in October. I'm going to the Philippines in a couple weeks, and I'm speaking there.
So you won't be here the second Tuesday of the month, but
we'll work on it. We'll figure out when I'm going to come in. Yep.
Thank you so much. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, a professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her along. She'll be back next month. Tomorrow we'll talk with Bob Wilging, the author of History Afield, Stories from the Golden Age of Wisconsin Sporting Life. Look forward to that, and look forward to you joining us on the Ideas Network.